prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And we have a special guest for this episode, writer and producer Joe Augustin, who not only wrote and produced the movie we're going to be covering for this episode, which is Night Angel, released in 1990, which currently has 464 views on Letterboxd. But Joe also created the original Night of the Demons franchise, having written and produced the original 1988 release, as well as writing the screenplay for Night of the Demons 2. And apart from his work in film, Joe is an author, having written numerous horror fiction novels and short stories, including The Nine Lives of Felicia Miller, Dead Rain, A Tale of the Zombie Apocalypse, and a collection of short stories, which I recently picked up and had a blast reading, called Bad Day in Paradise, Balls Out Tales of Terror. But before I welcome Joe onto the podcast, I have to mention a fairly recently published book of his, which I've chatted about on numerous past episodes, and that's Ghost Rider, The Polaroid Ghost and Other True Tales of the Paranormal. I'm fascinated by the events in this book. I loved reading it. We're eager to discuss Ghost Rider with him, as well as all the other things Joe's been involved in. So welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Great. Happy to be here. Thank you.
So while past guests we've had on our episodes are in some way associated with the film we're covering, we've actually never had someone who is so directly involved in creating the film we're covering. So this episode's format will be a little different from our norm to our listeners. So Joe, as the writer and creator of Night Angel, would you be willing to just dive right in, tell us not only what the movie's about, but what inspired you to write the screenplay and the character of Lilith?
Sure. I've always been interested, ever since I can remember, when I was a little kid, I'd go to the library and just devour books on everything related to the occult. At some point, I stumbled across the legend of Lilith, who supposedly it's included in Kabbalistic versions of the Bible. I never was ever tracked them down, but I did find references to them. And in a nutshell, Lilith was allegedly Adam's first wife, and she refused to be subservient, refused to let him get on top of her to have sex, basically, and eventually fled and went to the banks of either the Dead Sea or the Red Sea. I can't remember at this point, but she lived in, basically went and fled and hid out in a cave and began to fornicate with demons and gave birth to, you know, thousands of demon babies. But her whole thing, she hates true love. She hates any kind of marital bliss. She hates children. And in the Middle Ages, especially in Jewish tradition, people would create these amulets to put on their babies and their cribs and stuff to protect her from Lilith. And they also, I guess also in the Christian traditions, they would attribute certain like wet dreams to succubi. And Lilith is basically the archetypical succubus. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, the original. And her offspring are more like succubi who go and seduce men in their sleep, visit them at night and whatever. And I love the legend. As with Night of the Demons, when I was writing, I wrote both scripts back to back, basically back in the mid 80s. I went to Los Angeles from Philadelphia to study producing at the American Film Institute. And I worked in production on a few films. And then I ended up going back to Philly for a while for about 4 months or so. And while I was there, I basically just banged out these two scripts back to back. And then I got back to LA. I started getting action right away on Night of the Demons. I got writing assignments and whatever. And eventually Night of the Demons, I had a lot of offers on it. It was really hot script at the time. And eventually that one got made. After we wrapped Night of the Demons, I pitched the script to them, and I wasn't really sure they were going to go for it. And I still wanted to shop it around elsewhere because I saw it more, the original draft. The draft that of the film that you've seen is completely different from the original draft. The original draft was much closer to the legend. It basically started with an American oil engineer who was working in the Middle East, and he has a few days off. So he actually goes to Israel, and he falls asleep on the shoreline of the lake, and Lilith comes to him in the middle of the night and seduces him. And then the next day he wakes up and he's like kind of drained because the succubi are sort of like vampires, and he just writes it off as a dream. And eventually, after a few weeks, he returns to the States and to his fiance. And Lilith turns up, you know, at night back in his life, basically, and slowly begins the process of like draining him.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a lot closer. And when I pitched it, like, I actually wanted my agent to try to shop it. I saw it more as like a big studio film. But Walter Jostin, who was the executive producer of Night of the Demons and Witchboard, and, you know, those were the two horror films he had done at that point, was really adamant that he wanted the script after he read it. And I kind of regretted that I even gave it to him to read at that point. Mm-hmm. So, and then Walter finally really pushed me up against the wall and was, he basically twisted my arm, and I got into a deal with him. And I thought, well, if he loves the script so much, you know, at least we'll get it. He promised he would raise a bigger budget so that we could do it like studio film, that we would get a bigger director. As soon as I signed, when I did Night of the Demons, because I had had several offers on it before I signed a deal with them, I was really tough in negotiations, and I got a clause in it that gave me like basically creative control over the film. And with Night Angel, because he was so enthusiastic about it, I didn't even bother to do that. Mm-hmm. So it opened the door for an extended development process. And basically I struggled, you know, to try to keep it as much in line as I could. And then even when Dominique came on, the director, mm-hmm. we both were kind of in sync that we wanted Lilith. We were actually inclined to sort of get a woman who had Middle Eastern roots and would be more true to the character. And Walter's response to that was, well, if Lilith came back today, she would be an American woman with big American breasts. And so that's, we'll show just how far apart we were. And, you know, right. But at the same time, I became more philosophical after Night of the Demons. Because there were certain things in Night of the Demons that bothered me. They weren't big things. They were little things. But I realized that I had worried about them, you know, with little reason, that everybody has a different interpretation and they respond to things differently. So I thought maybe I'm not the, you know, final arbiter, or shouldn't be, a, you know, whatever is going to go into this film. So it just, what came out on screen basically was sort of an amalgamation of my ideas with Walter's and Dominique's, and that was it. And I was really happy when it was done. I mean, because we did get a lot of production value. I mean, we didn't really get the big budget that we were promised. And it was a hell of a shoot, literally. I mean, Night of the Demons, we had one main location and we had basically a month to shoot it. And with Night Angel, we had 28 locations and we had like 24 days to shoot it.
Wow.
And then we did like a week of pickups afterwards. And, you know, it has a much bigger cast, that it's just a much bigger mm-hmm. production with a lot more special effects. And we actually had two effects teams. We had Steve Johnson, who had done Night of the Demons, who's really great, who had done, you know, Poltergeist and had done a lot of big movies when he was the foreman for Dick Smith, who was a big effects guy. Mm-hmm. And we also, and Night Angel, we had also had K&B do some effects, and that's Greg Nicotero, who later became the executive producer of The Walking Dead and his company. So Night Angel has some interesting people connected to it. Mm-hmm. Doug Jones, who plays the goofball character. I don't know if you know who he is, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We love him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's great. And he's been in like 100 movies and TV shows, but he's always in makeup basically.
Right.
So we were the second producers to hire him on a movie, and one of the few that, in which he basically, you know, was a human being. and not a demon or some other creature.
Was this one of the first K&B effects gigs?
They had done, I think, about a handful of shows before that. They were coming up, though. It was, it was fun. All these effects guys had like their kind of warehouse setups up in the valley, and we would go up and check them out and look at what they had done before. And it's really funny because each of their studios had sort of a different kind of vibe to them too. And Steve was a little bit more kind of out there, and those guys were more kind of like heavy metalish. But they were all fun, and they were all really cool guys to work with. And K&B went on. I mean, they were sort of starting out at the time. They did the big effect at the end where she turns into the demon. I think the next thing they did after that, or shortly after that, they did Dances with Wolves. They did all the buffaloes. The dead buffaloes, whatever. So that was like a big step forward for them. But they've done a ton of stuff. And
so, yeah, Joe, you had mentioned that the director Dominic Othman-Girard was kind of, you guys were kind of on the same page for, you know, kind of where you wanted the movie to grow. This was his first American feature, right?
The company had done a film called Tips, which later was reshot and released under the name Pucker Up and Bark Like a Dog. And one of the writers of that was a guy named Mel Green. And Dominique actually had just moved to Los Angeles. He was living in Hollywood in a building that Mel was the manager of. Mel called us and asked us if we would take a look at this young director who just had come over. And we met him. And Jeff Jaffray is Cajun from New Orleans, basically. And so I think he liked the idea of working with a French director. And Dominique's wife was from South Philadelphia, and I was a Philadelphia native, so I hit it off with them, pretty quickly. And also, I was kind of like skewed towards bohemian kind of lifestyle, and so was Dominique. So on a personal level, everybody clicked, basically, and it was, and then we got started. And Dominique's a really strong director, has really strong ideas. He's also a really hard worker. I mean, the crew really loved working with Kevin Tenney on Night of the Demons, because Kevin basically knew what he wanted and got in and out. He worked the shortest days of any director I'd ever worked with, basically. But he got work done, and he got, a good product. And Dominique was the opposite. He wanted to every day to be like an 18-hour day and try to squeeze in as much as he could and more. So the crew wasn't as happy, but I don't mind working those long hours, or I didn't at the time.
So for some of our listeners who don't know Dominic, he also directed Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, which was filmed, I guess, after Night Angel, but it was released before.
Yeah, Night Angel got hung up on, I really don't even know what happened with Night Angel. I mean, we were all really excited about it. Then they just, they made a deal with Freeze Entertainment to take it out. And next thing I know, both Freeze and Paragon Arts were declaring bankruptcy, and they basically just dumped it and didn't do anything with it. But at the same time, that was an era where horror films were cyclical up until probably like 20 years ago, when they started to get, they've had a steady run for, I guess, the last 20 years. But before that, like in the 90s, there was a period where it was impossible to get anybody to even read a horror film at the studios or whatever. And then Scream was the only one that came along that sort of broke through that, and maybe like Candyman films.
Yeah, Dominic made, I watched this other thing on, it was on YouTube called The Hospice, 1987.
Yeah, that was one of the films that he showed us as a sample. And he also did a film called Cop Trap, Piège à Flic, which was a French, cop thriller, basically. And that one was more kind of straightforward. But Hospice was based on a story by Robert Aichman. Mm-hmm. I was a fan of Robert Aichman. So,
I enjoyed it. I think, for listeners, I haven't read that story by Aichman, so I can't really speak to it from that perspective. But it's about a guy who gets stranded and ends up at a hospice kind of in the middle of nowhere. And it's this weird situation about them trying to keep him there. And I don't want to give too much away because it's short. It's under an hour, but I think it's good for October. If
I think he did that. I think that was a student film that he did while he studied film at the London School of Film. Hmm. And I think that was his student film. And it's supposed to be a metaphor for reincarnation. And the guy is in the mystical realm between lives, you know, physical, corporal lives.
I could see that.
So Dominique did a really good job with Halloween 5. He, it's ironic because the Night of the Demons was originally called Halloween Party, and the producer of Halloween threatened a lawsuit if we kept that title. And basically, we could have kept it. Now there are a lot of films that come out with Halloween in the title.
Yeah.
But he, you know, at the time felt that we were like threatening his franchise. And so Kevin Tenney came up with the title Night of the Demons, and we changed that. And then Dominique eventually, he did another film, which was one of the Omen sequels, but he had a really bad time on that. He, I think, got sort of halfway through it, and the director was like, the producer was meddling so much that he eventually, I think, fired Dominique and took over the reins himself. And mm-hmm. I know it wasn't a happy experience. And then I guess after that, Dominique left for Europe and he did a bunch of German TV. And Isa Jenks, who played Lilith in the movie, also went back to Germany. She did, I think her next film was a German film. And then she did a bunch of German TV, which I think she's still doing up until today. And then I guess you guys know, and then Ashby, who's the hero in Night Angel, he went on to he does a lot of TV, but he also did some big movies. He was in Wyatt Earp. And
yeah, he was Johnny Cage in Paul W.S. Anderson's Mortal Kombat.
Thank you. I was mm-hmm. like, is that Mortal Kombat? It was bugging me, and I forgot to look it up before we started.
Was this his first feature for him as an actor? Or?
I think it was his first feature. I think he had done a little bit of TV stuff before that, but he sort of came out of nowhere, and he was a great guy. He was really easy to work with, and you know, he was really nice.
Yeah. And then diving into the cast some more, we also have Karen Black, who's Rita,
Karen was a sweetheart.
Well, and also speaking of some of great casting, I feel like we have to talk about Helen Martin, who plays Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
I
mean, yeah, Helen was great. Helen was, it's amazing. We were doing these 18-hour days. She would be up at, you know, until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And she was just a trooper. She was just so sweet. Never complained. It didn't matter how, you know, tough it was or whatever. And the same thing, Karen Black was, you know, she was just like, couldn't have been better, you know, really just sunk her teeth into the role and was great.
Yeah. I love that. How Sadie, Helen Martin's character is essentially, she's the hero in Night Angel, like a Van
Helsing. She's the hero.
Yeah.
In the original film, the original script that I wrote, she was part of a cult. They were sort of like a weird kind of mystical religious cult. And she was the head of it, but her son, who was like a middle-aged black guy, did all the action stuff basically. So at the end, when she slays Lilith and, you know, dives into the taxi cab and all, it seems a little crazy, but originally that was supposed to be done by a younger male, but Walter decided that we didn't need that. We could condense it into one character. And so I went with Sadie because she was, you know, I went like with Night of the Demons, I wrote a bunch of minority characters into it. And I mm-hmm. thought that it would be really cool to, and also an old woman would be wise, you know, so
I loved it. How she's the one who drives the dagger in. It's great.
Yeah.
And then I guess last, but certainly not least, you, Joe, you have a cameo, at least one in Night Angel, right? I know you're at the bar. That's you.
Yeah, I'm at the bar. I'm looking really scuzzy.
There's a lot of close-ups on, like, you know, I guess Dominique's like, okay, get another Joe shot.
Yeah.
Were you in the hell scene too? Were you in any makeup?
Yeah, I was in, we were, Walter Jostin, myself and Jeff are dressed as like popes and cardinals.
Okay.
The hell scene. I can't remember who was who, but we're in there basically in the makeup. So, and the other character who's Phil Fondacaro, who's the dwarf Samael,
yeah. mm-hmm.
is he was, I met him way back in when I was at AFI on a student film. And then I was really good friends with a producer named Steve Golan, who became, he recently passed away, but before that he won an Academy Award for Spotlight. He was producing a student film, and I just was helping him out doing Boom, and I met Phil. He was one of the stars of that little student film. And then later, Steve hired him to be in the Hard Rock Zombies and American Drive-In films. And so I knew him, and I liked Phil a lot. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years, but I wrote that role specifically for him and got him in there.
Yeah, that hell sequence is like...
Yeah.
It's so great with the gel lighting and just how much practical effects are thrown at you.
I love it. My head, here's where my head went. If you relocated, this is very specific, if you relocated the nightclub in Hellraiser 3, the boiler room, and I never advocate for Hellraiser 3 because I'm not a fan, but if you take that nightclub and put it in the underworld in Mario Bava's Hercules in the Haunted World, that is exactly what this hell scene is. I loved it. This is my favorite part of the movie.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It was fun shooting that too. We had...
The Susie Sparks who pops up and makes an appearance. That did, yeah, were there a lot of adult industry performers in that sequence, or
there were about somewhere there were at least three that I know of. We hired a guy, Bill Margulies, was like an adult manager or agent, and one of the line producers on the film had a contact with him, and so he roped this guy in, and he brought the people in. The girl who, there's a girl lying in bondage on a table, little blonde girl, she was one of them. But I don't even think she was an adult actress. I think she was just like a friend of Bill's. And then, and Susie Sparks, Walter, again, he wanted to, one of the reasons that I eventually parted company with Paragon and Blue Rider, which are Walter's companies, was because he kept always wanting to do the same kind of gags over and over again. And because in Night of the Demons, we had a breast gag that everybody kind of liked. He wanted to do another breast gag. And so that's the thing we did with Susie Sparks, basically.
Yeah. That was quite the, like when that happened, that was like, okay, was this funny. Movie just kicked, like really kicked off. This is going to be wild for the rest of the ride. I know it.
Yeah. I'm sad that more people aren't aware of this movie.
Yeah.
Even when I did Night of the Demons, I was all excited. We released that regionally, so it would play in all different cities, and in every city that it played, it would be like one city at a time, but there would be heavy advertising, and so anybody in that city who saw the ads on TV or whatever would assume it was like a big studio film. And it did really well. I mean, it was kicking ass in all the cities that opened, in Detroit and Washington, D.C., and all these big urban cities. And Philadelphia was the only one that didn't open, which was my hometown. And I got really pissed off. But they decided at the last minute, they were supposed to open it in Philly, and then they decided to open it in the Texas area instead. And when they opened it in Texas, there was a record like blizzard or something that weekend, and it totally like knocked the box office down. And after that, they decided to pull it from theatrically, and they had a really big offer for video. And so they just took that and cashed out on it, basically. And Night Angel played in the Los Angeles area, and it actually got really good reviews in like the LA Times and Variety. But then it just imploded after that. So which was frustrating. So,
I mean, I'm backtracking a little bit here, but with, we kind of mentioned Doug Jones already.
Yeah.
So something that we've brought up on the podcast a couple times before is dancing. Like we've talked about like Per Oscarsson in Backstock in previous episode. We've talked about Crispin Glover in Friday the 13th. I think we might have a new contender with Doug Jones, Ken's character at the nightclub. Because as soon as he hit the floor, I was like, oh, he's giving Crispin Glover a run for his money.
He was good. He was really, I mean, he was great. He was great to be around. And his dance scene is classic.
Balances. And I usually like to comment on the score for every episode and movie we talk about. So I know Corey Lirios provided the original score for Night Angel, which he also did Child's Play 3 and actually the comedy one, Crazy Summer. But To me, it's not about the original score. Like with Night of the Demons, the music selection and the actual songs, for Night Angels specifically, it's all about that Screaming Jay Hawkins song, Sirens Burning. Did you have, I know you had a big part in Night of Demons with, you know, Bauhaus and, you know, selecting the tunes. Did you do the same here?
With this one, I wanted them to get, Screaming Jay Hawkins had, his big hit was I Put a Spell on You. And so that's the song I wanted to go for. And we made a deal with him for that song. And then after we paid him and he spent all the money, he came back and told us that he actually had already sold the rights to somebody else.
Oh no.
And exclusively. And so he didn't have the rights to it anymore. And so we decided, well, why don't you write an original song? Then we'll do that instead. And so he wrote Sirens Burning specifically for the movie.
That's amazing.
Very
and
cool.
I liked that. It was great. I mean, it couldn't be better,
Yeah. It put a smile on my face because it shows up in the middle of the movie. And then at the end credits, it's reason enough to, if you ever need a reason to sit through and watch credits, it's if Sirens Burning's playing, because that I loved hearing him singing and just scream his head off.
Yeah, he was still, alive and kicking and doing, he was great. He had great energy. That was cool.
One of the most interesting things to me about this movie is, so after I watched it, I started poking around to see are there other, because, when we do our double feature recommendations at the end, I was like, I'm going to see if there's another Lilith movie out there that I can find that I could pair with this. And there's really not a lot. There's a lot of, I found a lot of TV episodes that featured a character named Lilith that were sort of based on that mythology, but there's really not a lot of movies, which seems like such a great concept. And that's the thing I like most about this is because, when you're describing Lilith as she hates this, she hates this, she hates this, I'm like, I identify with all of these things. Right. This is me. Yeah. Lilith hates children, that's me.
She's a proto-feminist, basically. She's the first, she's a proto-feminist demon.
Yeah.
And the Lilith Festival hadn't even existed back then, the music festival.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I wrote the script, it didn't exist yet. And then it came a little while later. Yeah, no, I love finding obscure legends and, I mean, I devour this stuff, so.
There was a short book out there called The Book of Lilith by Dr. Barbara Black Colto.
I had that book. She was hired as a consultant on the film. She should be on the credits on the back, and she gave me an autographed copy of that book. And then I was contacted about a year after we made the film by a friend knew I had done it, and he was friends with another director who wanted to do a similar film. And I won't mention the director's name. He's somebody you would know instantly. He's really big. He contacted me. He wanted to know if I would lend him the book. And I lend him the book. And I said, okay, but I want to get it back because, it was inscribed to me and whatever. And he's, oh, no problem. And then I didn't hear back from him for a while. And I finally contacted him. And he got really indignant. And he said, what book? You never gave me a book. It was really bizarre. And then I saw him at this mutual friend's wedding, a year after that. And he just was shooting me daggers and thought I was some kind of weird scammer. I don't know what,
Damn.
It was really bizarre.
Hmm. Well, that short book of hers, that leans more into the history of not only Lilith, but just feminism, right? That's the angle that.
Yeah, it covers a lot. It also just the whole succubus legends and, it was really in depth. It was a great book. And,
So I have a few random questions, Joe, that, just stuff that as I'm watching the movie, stuff pops up on screen. And there's a lot of what the fuck's happening on this movie. but I have a list of just a few questions that maybe they were just director choices and they just focused on stuff, but maybe not. So in the very beginning, when Lilith is kind of seducing Joseph, at Joseph's place, he's looking in his backyard and a llama head pops up.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that they had a llama on the property that we rented for the shoot. And Dominique thought it might be cool to just include it.
I was like, what does this mean? There's got to be.
Right. It has absolutely nothing to do with Lilith or, and okay. That's the kind of thing where I was at a point where I just, okay, whatever, it's like I lost perspective and wasn't, a year earlier, I might have like put my foot down and said, no, that's stupid. It doesn't fit and it doesn't do anything. And, but no,
it's fun stuff like that keeps, you know, viewers like me guessing like what? And okay. And another question is Lilith's symbol on her necklace, which is also the, like her hood ornament on her car.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Does that, does that symbol mean anything?
That Dominique wanted her to have a symbol for some reason. And so we worked with Jor and she came up with that. And it was something that I thought, okay, fine. You know, it's not any, you know, if people get it, they get it. If it means something, it's not any, you know, but it's not anything historical or part of the legend.
It's hysterical that it's on the car ornament. And then I have a specific character related question. So Craig, played by Lyndon Ashby, he seems to have some sort of connection with Lilith from the very beginning. He sees like the killings happening. I don't know if that was written into the script, if it happened in editing, but is there some sort of connection between the two characters that I just didn't really pick up on?
I think it's like a combination of like the writing, you know, writing what the action is and the fact that, and then the way it's interpreted by Lyndon, that's how it comes out. It's, you know, he put that into it. So, and then, you know, in editing too, that connects all this stuff and, you know, you create a lot of emotional stuff in editing. So just how you juxtapose, you know, the different shots and stuff like that.
Right.
And because Dominique was such a workhorse, he had a lot of stuff. He had tons of footage to work with in the editing room. He actually got lost in editing. He hired a first editor who basically convinced him, who was had done like one very artsy movie before that. He convinced Dominique that almost everything he shot was like trash and all the effect stuff and whatever the guy didn't like, and would try to, it was amazing. He had Dominique like second guessing himself and, you know, wondering if he had made a big mistake and made the wrong kind of movie. And that went on for a couple of weeks. And then finally he fired him and we brought in another guy, Jerry Brady, who was much more straightforward and helped him to get in shape and, you know, put it all together.
Yeah. Sounds like that editor was like seducing him like Lilith and Sadia. Right. Take care of the situation.
Yeah. I don't think he wanted to do that kind of movie. It's like, I don't even know why he took the job. You know?
Right. I did see that Night Angel was featured on Joe Bob's Drive-In Theater in 1991.
Yeah, he gave it a couple of Joe Bob awards, whatever.
Yeah, he was like a big fan of it. Like, that's funny.
Yeah.
So now I definitely want to talk a little bit about, you know, the paranormal experiences and Ghost Rider as well, because I picked up that book. So we did a previous episode on John Huckert's The Passing. It was a pick that I was really into. And that's when I found out about his cabin in LA and then Rider and all these Polaroids that were out there. Became infatuated about it. Vocally, I was just going on and on about it on numerous episodes. And John actually messaged us. He had listened to the podcast, which was awesome. And he let us know, you know, where the book was at ghostpolaroids.com. You know, gave us a little background on you. And I picked up the book. I just sat down.
He should have signed your copy.
It's fine. We don't mind, like, you know, shelling out. Well, I didn't buy it because I don't believe in ghosts. But Lance does. So
Erica is a skeptic.
That's an understatement.
Well, I know that, I mean, you had mentioned that in the book that you had family members that had experienced like ghostly encounters. And, you know, I had some too, like as my family. And I don't know if Erica, if you ever did.
No.
See, and I don't know if that's some sort of, I can't say that a belief system is like programmed in you, but I think it opens you up.
Oh my God.
I do.
Did you see Bill Maher this week? Do you watch Bill Maher's show?
I catch recaps on YouTube. I don't have HBO though. So
Bill Maher has always been really skeptical about everything paranormal.
Sure.
And finally on this show this week, he was talking to one of the editors of Reason magazine, but it was some rationalist. And he brought up the subject of ghosts and mentioned his friends who have had ghostly experiences. And he said, these are people who are really intelligent. They're not crazy. They're not this. And they tell me, you know, I saw the table move across the room and other stuff. And like you could tell he was really moved by this and is starting to doubt his former skepticism. And that's a huge step, because I actually mention him in my book in the preface. I talk about how he was in one show that I saw years ago. He basically was really like scoffing, and, you know, and I don't care if people scoff or they don't, you know, mm-hmm. are skeptical or don't believe, whatever. In my book, I even say I'm just as annoyed at people who are overly eager to believe that they'll just lap up whatever paranormal or fake paranormal stuff. They're just not discriminating enough. And there was a parapsychologist named Nandor Fodor, who had been one of Jung's students, I guess. He's Hungarian. He's my ideal. I mean, he basically investigates paranormal stuff, but he's very thorough and he debunks as much stuff as he, I mean, this was like 50 years ago when he was working, but he did a great little kind of encyclopedic book on different phenomena, which was, you know, one of my favorite books. But I've had so many experiences ever since I was a little kid. I mean, I've had experiences and they don't always happen. Like I can move into a house that seems like it should be haunted and there's nothing. And then I'll be in a place that's newer or whatever. And then there's stuff that happens. So it's not something that happens all the time. I don't think it's being generated by me. And also some of the physical stuff, I have absolutely no explanation for, other than there's some kind of energy. I don't know if it's ghosts. I don't know if it's one of the poltergeist theories is that the poltergeist energy is actually generated from living people in the household. They usually attribute it to like adolescent girls or whatever, because they're pretty commonly associated with it. But, I can tell you some things that happened here. Like I have a house in Philadelphia now where I live, and it's a nice neighborhood. And when I moved in, it's like a very family oriented neighborhood. It's really unusual for the city here. And I found this house that it was vacant at the time. It had been vacant for like 30 years in the middle of a neighborhood where all the other houses were really well kept. And the house next door was like really well kept. It has an enclosed porch, and all the windows of the enclosed porch were covered with trash bags when I bought it. I mean, the place was really like abandoned, but it was still nice inside, hardwood floors, cool little like chandeliers in two of the rooms downstairs. Nothing had been stolen out of it. The woodwork had incredible woodwork. It was built like in 1925 by this guy who came over from Europe, who was like a master craftsman. And it was, as soon as I saw it, I fell in love with it. But it was totally, we needed to redo all the plumbing, because the last owner of it was like a crazy guy. The house had always been in the hands of one family since 1925. And the last guy who inherited it, but he was like so out of it that he never fixed the pipes. And so he died, and then the property fell into the hands of like a nephew or something who lived in New Jersey. And he just wanted to sell it. So I bought the place. It was like 20 grand. And the houses in the next door neighbor's house is at the time worth about 150. So it was like, you know, the old real estate thing is, you know, buy the worst house in the best neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so I bought it and we started to work on it. My brothers were coming over to help me do it. We were going to do all the work ourselves. One day, my brother Ron came over and he was going to help me fix the toilet. And I was going to help him. It was a cramped space. So he was in there doing the work and I was standing outside the door, handing him tools and whatever parts. And all of a sudden I heard this weird sound downstairs on the first floor. There's nobody else in the house. And it sounded like birds flapping their wings, but really like a huge bird flapping, whatever. And it was just weird. And I went downstairs, there's nothing there. And I went back up and I was like, did you hear that? And he was like, no, I didn't hear anything. Cause he was like in the, you know, little cubby hole. And then a few seconds later, I heard this loud crash downstairs. It sounded like somebody had carried a metal tool box filled with tools and just slammed it down on the floor. And at that point, I ran downstairs thinking that it was somebody trying to prank me. There was nobody there. I ran outside, looked up and down the street. There was nobody in sight anywhere. It was nobody. Nobody, you know, it was weird. And then later I was, in the house by myself at night, and I was working. I was like in the front room. I just had a mattress put down because everything was still, you know, in the process of being redone. But I was plugged into the internet. I was like cruising the internet. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I always stay up all night, basically. That's I keep like vampire hours. And at about probably like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I heard the back door to the house open. It leads into the yard, and I had bells on it. Just hung bells there as sort of like a cheap burglar alarm system. And I heard the bells jingle, and I heard the door open and like slam against the chain lock. And then I heard my oldest brother, Al, his voice just calling my name. And I thought, and he wasn't in town. He lives in 90 miles away in Jersey. And I thought, oh, what the fuck is, you know, he's doing here at, you know, it was a Friday night. And I thought that he probably came into town and went out to the bars and got drunk. And now he was coming to crash at my place. So I ran downstairs to open the door. And when I got to the kitchen, the door was closed. It wasn't even open and there was nobody there. But the weirdest stuff happened. I took my parents in when they were really old to take care of them. After my mother passed away after a few years, the day after she died, I was talking on the phone, and as we were talking, I heard this loud metallic crash somewhere in the house. I didn't even know where it was. And it was so loud that the friend on the phone said, "What was that? Did you drop pots and pans or something?" And I said, "No, I don't know what it is. Hold on." And I went all through. I went down to the kitchen first because it did sound like pots and pans. There was nothing there. I went all through the house. I finally went into the back bedroom. When I heard it, I was in like middle bedroom, and I went into the back bedroom, which is my office, and there were quarters scattered all over the floor. And I realized that was what the sound was. And I was like, where did that? And I looked at it, and one of the quarters was sitting in this white plastic cap from a pill container. And then I realized that my mother kept a whole bunch of a stack of quarters in one of those amber plastic pill things to use for parking meters and stuff like that when she went out. And after she died, when I was like cleaning stuff up, I found it and I didn't want to deal with it. So I put it in the top drawer in a bureau in that room. And somehow it got out of a closed drawer and shattered on the floor.
Wow.
And I could not explain that. And then later when my father died, the same thing. I was like upstairs in the room, wide awake, and I heard a big metal banging around. And that time I went straight back to the office, and there was a metal ceiling fixture that I had removed from the hallway. This one had been sitting on another like bureau dresser in that room, and somehow it flew off and went 6 feet across the room and went on the floor. And then the final thing happened when I had a cat that was my favorite cat. I loved him. He came with me from California and had been with me for years, and he passed away. And then like a day or two after he died, I was like, again, up in my room. And all of a sudden I heard this weird noise. I couldn't tell what it was, but it was like a rolling sound. And I went to my office and the door was closed, and I opened the door and there was a little crystal ball that I had on a curio shelf, like cat corner all the way across the room. And somehow it had fallen off the thing and rolled all the way to the door, basically. I just can't explain those things. And, you know, it could be some kind of weird energy. There was nobody else in the house. There was no way, even if I had a cat at the time, there was no way the cat could have, you know, gotten in a drawer and pulled out the thing and thrown it or knocked that big other metal lamp thing around.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the stories that you just kind of told or in the Ghostwriter book, like the first half or yeah. Your paranormal experiences, then it goes to the Ghostwriter. I mean, did you already have plans to write a book about your own experiences, or did the Ghostwriter kind of jumpstart the idea?
It's interesting. I experienced the stuff that the Ghostwriter stuff in the early 90s. John Metkowski is actually the owner of the house, and we went to film school together at Temple before I went to AFI. And then after I moved to LA, he moved out here and, you know, we were roommates for a while. He bought this house. It's like a little kind of log cabin up. Technically it's in the city limits, but if you are in the house, at least when I was back there, it was like a double lot, and the front lot was just filled with a forest, basically, literally a forest of trees. So you get the feeling, if you're sitting on the porch, it's like being out in the country, basically, although you're in the city. It's really great. It's a nice. Great property. And I spent some time there, and I had some weird experiences, but just minor stuff that, you know. And then he started telling me about, I went over one day, and they showed me these Polaroids. And the first one that they got was the one, I call it the poodle skin, which I think it's on the cover of the book. It was just really dramatic looking. And there were actually a sequence of two or three where, and it's the same image, but in different forms, like it looks like it's moving forward in the second one. And then I kind of, you know, I was impressed by it, but at the same time, I wasn't totally sure if I bought it or if it was some kind of hoax. And then I went to a Halloween party at their house. And while I was there, it's like, it started off, everybody brought their, half the guests had Polaroid cameras that they brought with them. You know, people were snapping pictures, but they weren't getting anything. And then I was outside talking to some friends, and all of a sudden we could hear the energy level in the house go way up and all this murmuring and whatever. And we thought, oh, let's go check it out. So we walked in, and everybody at once started getting different ghost photos. And it was crazy. I mean, I just was there. I saw people snap a picture, pull it out of their thing, and there would be these weird, you know, the one I remembered was a guy came, I think he was dressed like the Grim Reaper. And when they snapped a picture of him, it was like a side view of him. And when it came out, there were all these squiggles, like just waves of them, like emanating from like his face mask, basically. And it looked like, you know, if you made those squiggles red, it would look like somebody just blew his head off with a shotgun or something.
Yeah, I remember that in the book.
He got so freaked out that he left the party right then. And so to answer your question, I guess it was about 5 years later. I don't know if John Matkowski asked me if I had any interest in writing a book about it or whatever, but for whatever reason, I started to write a book specifically about their house. And so I wrote down everything that I remembered. And it's good that I did, because if I had waited until I actually finished the book, I would have forgotten a lot of the details. I started to write it, and then I got like a writing assignment. I got a movie assignment, and I got distracted by that. And then I ended up like leaving LA and moving back east, and just got swept up. When I got back here, I got another writing assignment, and it took me a few years to be able to get back to clear the decks and get back to it. And I was really happy that I had started it, because I had the bones of the story, everything that had to do with that. And so, but it still, I felt, wasn't enough to do a whole book. So I decided, well, I might as well, you know, I had my own experiences and my family's experiences, and I thought, well, let me incorporate them. And the publishers had a connection with Dan Aykroyd, and somehow they got the book to him, and then he did this glowing intro, basically. And
yeah, it's great.
Contributed, and it was pretty amazing. So we had published it before that, a version that I published on Amazon, and it got a handful of reviews, and we got one bad review from a guy who just didn't believe, you know, that I had all those experiences in my life.
That's rude. So, like leaving a negative look. I mean, look, I even said I don't believe, but I would never leave a negative review about it. It's just like, this is just something that's never happened to me, and I'm a person. It's like, it's got to happen to me. I got to see it to believe it. So right. That's my level of skepticism. That's yeah. The fucking shithead who left a negative review. I don't believe in this. Right. One star. Fuck that guy. Yeah.
What can you do? I've had bad reviews. My book Felicia also got mostly great reviews, and then there was one woman who absolutely hated it and totally skewered it. So I think there every book has to have at least one like really trashy review. Yeah. So
cool. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fascinating book. I've already recommended it on numerous episodes, so I'm recommending it here again to people who are interested in that type of paranormal stuff. So yeah, I mean, let's go ahead and do our double feature picks with Night Angel. This is the part of the episode where we usually like to pair, you know, what would play well with the film we're covering. And Joe, do you have a
pick? I think that probably the one film that I would pair with it, which is similar, is there's a film called Siren, which is about a group of guys who go, I think it's a bachelor party, and they end up going to like a strip joint or something way out in the country. And there's one particular woman there who, you know, turns out to be a succubus. And It's low budget, but it's a lot of fun. It's really well done. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I thought it was just, you know, I think it would be a perfect pairing with Night Angel.
Nice.
So, I mean, if you wanted to go for straight horror, my two favorite horror films recently, or one is called Haunt. I don't know if you've seen it, about a group of people who go to one of those
Haunted houses.
And then The Autopsy of Jane Doe is one.
I really enjoyed that one.
That's my dream. I have a new script that I just wrote called Hannah's House, and I would love to get the director of Jane Doe to do it. But I, you know, we'll see what happens.
What about you, Erica?
So I was going to go the succubus route because, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, there's not really like that many straight Lilith movies. So, mm-hmm. but like the succubus is sort of the next iteration of that.
Yeah.
So I instead decided to go for more of like a plot point similarity. And so I went with another movie that centers around a magazine where people are getting killed off in it. So I picked Delirium from 1987, directed by Lamberto Bava and starring Daria Nicolodi.
Yes.
That was my Daria Nicolodi pick for this month's Horror Gives Back challenge anyway. So, and actually Sam Deegan recommended it when she was on a guest for our Patrick Still Lives episode. And I finally got around to watching it. It's great. It's about a former sex worker who runs a popular magazine, and someone is killing the models who are being featured in it. It's one of the few in like the late 80s Italian horror that, you know, it's, you know, we like that little niche in this podcast. So I had to throw this one out there. So,
right.
Yeah, it's got some really great surreal murder set pieces as standout scenes. So like when you think about like the nightclub hell scene in Night Angel, there's two in particular murder set pieces where the victims have these weird masks on their face as part of the murder itself. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's really cool.
Is it like a giallo or?
I mean, it is a murder mystery. So yeah, mm-hmm. you could call it that for sure. I get nervous with that word because so many people are throwing it around lately that I'm just okay, murder mystery first and foremost, you know, really cool murder set pieces. Yes, then I could definitely.
And I guess there are specific, like I just read something where they were talking about specific conventions to the giallo genre, which I didn't really, you know, they seem pretty restrictive, but for the description of the genre, but I don't know.
And the thing is like my first criteria is murder mystery because that's the origin of it, that it comes from these books. I heard someone call stage fright a giallo and I nearly lost my shit because I was like, you know who the murderer is the whole time. There's no fucking mystery. Stage fright is not a giallo. Stop it, people out there in the universe who are calling it that. It's not.
I think you might like my Hannah's House. It's really, it's got a murder theme in it and it's pretty interesting.
All right. Lance, your double feature pick.
Yeah, so mine is going to be considered very lazy. It's very straightforward. This is the episode that's dropping right before Halloween, so I'm going for the perfect Halloween movie.
Okay.
And that's Night of the Demons.
Well, obviously.
Obviously the original 1988 one. I would pair this well. Obviously, I think it'd go well because it's, you got Joe Augustin, you have Steve Johnson, it's like a Paragon Arts double feature. I would call it the Night of Augustin Nights. Do you get it? Erica?
I think it's great.
Night Angel, Night of the Demons, Night of Augustin Nights. No? No?
Okay. Nobody? All right. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
That's what I would do. I did want to ask you, though, did you watch the 2009 Night of the Demons?
I did. You know, the old saying.
I made it 5 minutes and I turned it off.
I mean, I was expecting to be sadly disappointed and my expectations were met.
Yeah. And that, from a business standpoint, I got kind of porked on that one. So, it's a really bad experience for me, that whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I didn't like it then.
Same.
I actually saw the original recently. It just came up on Shudder and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. I was ready to go to sleep and I thought, let's just see what is up on Shudder now. Yeah. and it had just come up, and I watched the whole thing and didn't get to bed. And then I got all excited. I watched it and I couldn't go to sleep, and I was up until like 10:30.
Oh,
it's so much fun. Crazy.
It is. And
I rewatched it too recently.
Yeah. Same. It's perfect. October Halloween movie.
I do. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's like a,
and I can't believe how I think part of it is because everybody's in costume. So it's not really dated as far as like clothing and all that. And
yeah, like Night Angel, also, fashion in Night Angel is definitely a product.
Yeah.
Definitely,
yeah. You know, I wanted to be careful not to try to date things. And, but like all the costumes and stuff in Night Angel, that's, the costumers had their ideas about what to do and all that. So
it's like a rated R Saved by the Bell episode.
Yeah.
When I was looking at some of the stuff, I was like, oh, I mean, it's very endearing and fun to watch because of, you know, just the fashion.
Yeah.
Like Karen Black and her shoulder pads. And
it's like, instead of Jesse popping caffeine pills, she's popping ecstasy and everyone's just super fucking horny all of a sudden.
All right, Joe. So, is there anything that you're working on at the moment? I mean, you mentioned the, what was it?
Yeah, I've got a couple of scripts that I've veered off into writing books for a while. And then I was under the delusion that every horror fan who likes movies would also dive in and want to read books. And that didn't turn out to be the way. So, but I have a couple of scripts. I actually have a producer that I'm working with now named Scott Perlman, who's got an option on one of my scripts called At Death's Door, which is sort of a twist on the vampire thing. I think it's pretty cool. But, and then Hannah's House, which is like a haunted house kind of thing. And I have another one that I finished about a year ago called Bad Things Happen in Philadelphia. And it's basically my way of coping with all the violence in the city, which is just insane. Yeah. So, but it's a sort of a supernatural cautionary tale, basically. So I'm hoping that, you know, one or all those three get made, and we'll see. But that's it.
Cool, yeah. And the books I've read, like I said, I picked up the Balls Out Tales of Terror.
Right.
Those are a lot of fun. I mean,
oh, I'm glad you liked it because that's the only feedback I've gotten on it, basically.
Oh. So. Well, I mean, the holiday season's coming up to everybody. You can find these books on Amazon. I know for Ghostwriter, ghostpolaroids.com. Thanks for spending your time with us.
Hey, it was great. It was great. I've done a bunch of blogs, whatever. This was the most fun.
Oh, thanks so much.
Guys are great. You're really sharp.
I appreciate, I do appreciate all the stories and that you just, Lance shoots me dirty looks every time I say I don't believe in ghosts. And
I don't. I like to tease Erica. I mean, we have different perspectives on that. That's
well, maybe some night you'll feel a cold hand.
I mean,
your forehead.
If it happens to me, if something,
I hope it's tonight. Oh my gosh, I hope it's tonight.
I've been in this house long enough. Something would have happened by now. It's fine. I'll move in. There's a cemetery on the street next over. So
there's a huge cemetery in my neighborhood, right? And supposedly, I heard that the neighbors on the next block, which is on a line with mine towards the cemetery, their house actually, their backyard fronts the cemetery.
Oh, wow.
And supposedly their house is loaded with activity too.
That would be amazing.
I would not mind that.
The other thing that's weird is when I bought this house, it had been vacant for like 30 years. And the Arabs believe that in their mythology that if a place is abandoned for a while, that the spirits move in, basically. Mm. And
that
so.
Makes sense.
But then the woman who lived next door told me about all the people who died in this house. And
that's in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So it's,
pick up the book if you want to know that, folks. Know.
Yeah. I'm going with Spirit Squatters.
Right. Yeah.
It's a good title.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us for this. Everyone, pick up those books. Watch Night of the Demons. Night Angel, I don't know if we mentioned it. It does have a Kino Blu-ray.
Yeah, Kino Lover has a Blu-ray and a DVD release. I picked up the DVD because I think the Blu-rays are sold out. But
bummer. Yeah. All right. Check all those out. We will have we're going to do a short promo for our network, and then we'll be back with our next pick for the next episode.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
October is almost over. We are still doing Horror Gives Back. It is not too late for you to, you don't have to start necessarily Horror Gives Back just now and follow our categories. Right. But if you have been watching horror movies, you can still make a pledge to donate per horror movie that you watch in October to the Trevor Project. We have a link in our bio. This is the last time I'll plug it, I promise, but it's a great cause. You're watching horror movies anyway. You can donate a dollar per movie that you watch, folks. Next episode, next month.
Yes.
We're doing something a little different for next month, which I'm excited about. We're doing No Rules November.
No Rules November.
So we are throwing out our Letterboxd limit rule for the month of November. We are each going to have one pick where the movie can have more than 1,000 views on Letterboxd.
And it can be a buddy comedy, right? I got that right?
No.
Oh, it has to be a horror.
Horror movie.
Okay.
We're still sticking with that.
Okay.
Thank you. But we're still going to sort of keep with the spirit of this podcast. We're not going to be doing Friday the 13th or Freddy or Chucky or anything like that. Right. So don't worry. We're not veering too far off course here, but there are movies that both of us love and would just want an opportunity to talk about them. So if you know me, if you know this podcast, I think some of you should know, or at least not be surprised. I mean,
yeah, you could even like make up a title and you might guess it.
All right, so I'm kicking off No Rules November with one of my absolute favorite movies of all time, the Spanish horror Who Can Kill a Child from 1976.
Yes.
As of this viewing, who fucking cares how many views it has? Because we don't have to abide the rule next month. This does have a Mondo Macabro Blu-ray. And if anyone has not seen Who Can Kill a Child, oh my God, you've never seen this movie.
I'm raising my hand. I have not seen it. It's been sitting in my watch list for, I guess, probably my whole life. There's a lot of movies. Don't be one of those people.
I'm not. But this is like this is in my top four.
Right. I know.
It's on Letterboxd. It's there. It's always been there. And
have you seen Fire Walk With Me, Twin Peaks?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I've seen it.
I'm trying to think what else is in my top four.
Rear Window, Assault on Precinct 13. Oh, yeah. Yeah, come on. Yeah. I know you. How dare you?
There's millions of movies that
I know.
Okay. But no, I'm very, very excited to scratch this off my list and fall in love with it.
So everyone else has seen this movie except Lance. So Lance, this movie is about a couple vacationing in Spain, and they visit a remote island only to discover there are no adults, and the kids are acting very strangely. Yeah, that's it. I don't know. Buy the Blu-ray if you don't have it. I guess you have to borrow mine, Lance.
I'll buy it.
Okay.
I'll blind buy it.
If you're not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Slasher, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Hex Massacre.
I'm Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at L Shibe.
Still have pins at Lance's shop.
Yeah, lanceshibe.bigcartel.com. Check out the Unsung Horrors pins. Be sure to use the Unsung Horrors discount code, all one word, all caps. You'll get 25% off. Not just the pin, but anything you want to buy from my shop.
Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you back next month.
No Rules November!
Thanks for listening, y'all.
Bye.
solid.